problem. But we went in depth with those, didn't we? Or did I just give you an overview of what they were? Did we do like the five yamas and the five niyamas? Did we define them and go over them? We did, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, briefly.
It wasn't in depth.
So those are like, you know, if you were to go to a fancy cocktail party with a bunch of yogis and you knew the yamas and the niyamas, you'd be good, right? if you were to go to a cocktail party, they might ask you a few more words about the Yoga Sutra. So we'll define a few more terms in here that are like some key concepts, and then we'll do the energy work, okay?
Yeah.
Sound good? I'm just gonna lock, I think I need to lock the door, just to make sure, I don't know, just make sure no one is in, so it's taking it. And then I'll come off, and then we'll do more, and do a little bit of.
Yeah, I don't think we went over this specifically, because I think I would have notes on it. But really, the
I don't know.
Like what each one?
She went through them all.
We did some of them.
Maybe we did some of them and not all of them.
I have my notes. That was from the 26th.
Right here, Niyamas, Sutra, Saucha, Santosha, Tapas.
Tapas.
Svadhyaya.
Svadhyaya. So that's the Niyama.
But then you didn't, but the Yama you did.
I didn't go through the Yamas. Okay, let's do that. Because those are things that we want to know.
Okay. Yeah, it was.
And so let's just go real briefly, because so for your mind, Candace, and I have a similar mind, so I understand what you're saying, is, and I wish I had a whiteboard, just so I was saying, is to look at. So we're talking about Hatha Yoga, we're talking about Raja Yoga. Raja Yoga being what was called like the King's Yoga. Raja Yoga is one of the branches of yoga. That's really what you're learning, okay? It's not Bhakti, right? Bhakti is like the kirtan and the devotional prayers. And this is like most asana kind of based practices like this is Raja Yoga. And Raja Yoga is the eight limbs. When we talk about the eight limbs, it's the eight limbs of yoga. The eight limbs, like in your manual, was that, remember that little flower image that was in here? This one. With the eight limbs. Okay. And we started to look at this on page one. On page two. Here, let's go see here. History and philosophy. Next page. Introduction. Let's look at the bottom there because I see that it says here. The limbs are not yoga. They are tools for yoga. That's what they're calling them here. They are the tools of Raja Yoga. And then you'll go to the next page. Purpose, benefit, and the limbs. So we started with yamas and niyamas. We started going over what these are. The internal and external observances. The niyamas are the internal ones that tell us how we can live our life. And the yamas are the external ones that tell us things like, don't kill someone, more clothes, you know, more life. But we started going over each, so I'm just giving you an overview. Then we have these eight limbs. Yamas and niyamas are the first two limbs. And then it goes up in this picture. You might see this, sometimes they do trees, sometimes you might see these branches, but asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. And we did talk about these, so yamas and niyamas being those moral codes and the internal observances, asana being the physical postures, pranayama being breath control, how we control our breathing patterns. Pratyahara, withdrawing our senses so that we can start to go into an internal practice. And then dharana and dhyana. Dharana is focus concentration, really focusing inward on usually one pointed focus, which could be the breath, it could be an image, and then getting to a place of dhyana. And dhyana is like absorption. It's meditation, but it's such deep meditation that eventually you get so absorbed in the thing that you are meditating on that you merge with oneness. That is samadhi, in the last line. Now, in a yoga class, people say, well, do you do all 8 limbs in a yoga class? You could, potentially. You could talk to some of the sutras, some of the limbs, like what's a yama or what's a niyama. You're obviously doing asana in class. You're practicing pranayama in class. You're practicing pratyahara in class because you're withdrawing people's senses from the outer world to get focused. Eventually concentrate dharana, and to hopefully eventually meditate in class, which would be like a conscious meditation of shavasana. Do you hit samadhi in class? Some people might. That would be amazing. Glimpses of it, maybe one day, right? And so yeah, this is what we're practicing in class, are generally these 8 limbs.
So 8 limbs of yoga, you could say, are 8 limbs of Raja Yoga.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, do we do this offerment? Some of them, right? Like the niyamas and the yamas, you could practice those things without being on the mat in the classroom. Do I practice nonviolence, which is the first niyama, ahimsa? Yeah. I don't go around killing people. Not yet, anyway. So I'm practicing it outside of the classroom, right? Do I practice pratyahara, like withdrawing my senses? Yeah, all the time, like when I'm going into states of meditation and things like that. So it doesn't always have to be in the classroom. And so it's a full set of basically tools for life, is the way that some yogis would think of the limbs. Like, how to live a yogic lifestyle. Does that make sense? How to live a yogic lifestyle. And so we talked a little bit, and it's broken down in here, so we can go over each of the yamas and each of the niyamas again, just so you have an overview today. The asanas we're learning in this classroom, where we break down the postures. Pranayama, I think we're learning more pranayama with Natalie. Right? Have you guys been doing a little pranayama yet? Or not quite.
Not really.
Okay.
I feel like
you will.
Is it Sophia that you did it with?
You did some breath? Okay, good. I'm here on Sunday. I'll teach some different pranayama techniques as well. She's having me teach the Sunday morning. And then pratyahara, dhyana, and dharana. These are more towards like deep meditative practices. And what's interesting about all of this information is that in the Yoga Sutras, it's the only time that they actually even really mention the asana. To them, asana is meditative seat. It's not a series of postures like we learn these days. And we talked a little bit about that last time. So it wasn't like, hey, go do a bunch of warrior twos, and you know, the asana was like this. That's your asana. Maybe some stretching, but it was really minimal. It's mentioned at all in the Yoga Sutras. That came later, the physical aspect. Because, why do you think we need asanas these days?
We all say we're active in our lives.
And also people are restless.
Right.
Like they can't just
sit. They can't sit, yeah. That's it. It's lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, now we've got so much sensory stuff coming our way. Back, you know, in these days, let's say, before this was even written, and some of the other texts were written, a lot of people were, you know, farming and doing the basic, and not that that's not a hard job, right? Mm-hmm. I don't mean to make it sound like that, but they were in tune with the earth, they were doing things for their just basic functioning, right? How do we eat? Where do we get clean water? Do we kill an animal? Do we hunt? You know, basic stuff. Now, it's like sensory overload. We can't sit, like you said. We're very restless. We have a lot of thoughts, and the mental mind is over asana practice, like you were saying, is to move the body and to get ourselves in touch with our bodies again, and in touch with our emotions again, in touch with our breath, and to re-inhabit the body, right? And that's, you know, the practices that all of us are doing. It's like, how do we get ourselves back in our bodies?
Mm-hmm.
And so now, asana has a different skill set, if you will, on here. And some would argue that you don't even reach those upper states of dharana, dhyana, and samadhi ever. I mean, that's what some teachers believe, like, we don't concentrate anymore, we don't focus anymore, we don't really meditate, it's kind of, you know, so there's that argument. And then some would say, well, you know, that's not really fair, because some people can achieve that. So, practice. Like anything, the Yoga Sutras it's almost like a scientific lens. It's like, do this thing and see what happens. And if that doesn't work for you, try this thing and see if that works. And if that doesn't work, try this one. What it's brilliant at, the Yoga Sutras, is walking you through processes with a hope of always achieving enlightenment at the end. So it's like always giving you like this hope that like, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it. And it'll just keep throwing things at you until you can do it. There's four books in the Yoga Sutras. We might have gone over this last time. They're called padas or chapters. And let me open this up. This should say in here what the order of them is. But usually the first one is about samadhi. Because, yeah, samadhi pada. And they call it the portion on contemplation. Look at my books falling apart. The portion on contemplation. It's contemplating samadhi. It's contemplating what is it to reach a full state of enlightenment. So that's the name of the chapter. Would you like to know? They open the book and you go, yeah, tell me how to do that. Well, before they're going to tell you how to do it, they're going to just tell you what it is. So that's where we kind of get, and in this book, in the Yogic Sutra framework, what it is getting to a place of understanding that this type of yoga is dualistic. Some people don't believe that, but there's different varieties of yoga. The Vedanta yoga is all about oneness. We talked about this last time. Tantra is all about oneness. But what's interesting about the Yoga Sutras is slightly different. It eventually talks about we all reach oneness, but it's dualistic. It says all of nature, everything around us, is one thing, including us. And then there's God and oneness, but they're separate. So you go through this life trying to transcend this life to get to the place of oneness. Whereas Tantra, for example, would say that everything is one. God created everything, therefore everything that exists is God. Who's that?
Are you recording?
Oh.
That was some good.
I turned mine off. I didn't see you have it phone on. So I don't know if it's as clear enough.
Okay. This is totally fine. We're in a good spot. Okay. So let me just repeat the philosophy of the Yoga Sutras. And so the philosophy of the Yoga Sutras is that of duality. And that is what most, I would say, a majority of yoga texts and philosophies resonate with. And then there's things like Tantra and Vedanta, which are non-dual. Now it's getting tricky because these days there's a little bit of a merge happening. It's an interesting philosophical question. So the Yoga Sutras would say, all of nature, which is called prakriti, want to say that with me? Prakriti. All of nature including human beings, right? We're part of nature in this philosophy, is separate from God, source, universe, whatever you want to call it. And here we call it Ishwara Pranayama, that's the extreme absolute bliss. So you spend your time as a yogi contemplating samadhi, bliss, Ishwara. You basically are working with your whole eight limbs of yoga to get to eventually transcending prakriti. Okay? Does that sound familiar to any of you guys?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right? It's kind of similar to like Catholic religion, some religions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is where people get, you know, it gets tricky because some people say yoga's a religion, and some people say no, yoga's a philosophy. Some people say yoga's a science, or a scientific philosophy, right? Or it's the devil's work, which is what
the cult.
Vedanta Yoga and Tantra say everything is one, it's non-dual. Everything is made by one source, and therefore everything is God. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Right? A lot of people believe that. And I'm not even sure sometimes what I believe, because I almost feel like it's part of all the same thing to me. It's like, to me though, and this is just my personal, and you guys can chime in about what you think. I feel like I'm in a dualistic environment. I feel like there's a lot of polarity, there's a lot of opposites. And in a way, I do use the yoga practice to transcend my subconscious mind, which I believe to be my past and some of my unconscious behaviors, to a place of consciousness so I can be as conscious as I can be, as often as I can be, which would feel like being in my heart. That feels like I'm part of nature. That feels like, and this is just my experience, that feels like I'm transcending something to get to some other place in a way. Now, I also believe that everything is made out of one source and one energy, and that we've forgotten that part. And so it is interesting because that separation to me, and so that does relate to things. But I don't know. Now the tantric yogis, what's interesting about the tantric yogis is they would say, well, we have this body. This is why people get confused about tantra being some sort of sexual, like erotic, like only an erotic practice. They're like, well, we have this body. We can orgasm. We can do these things with our bodies. So why not indulge and enjoy that part of ourselves? Whereas, you know, in some religions, they would say, well, why would you do that? That's shameful. That's bad. And they would say, why would that be bad? Everything's made out of God. Everything should be celebrated. So you get to choose, right? It's not, no one's telling you what to do or what to believe. I'm just giving you different lenses for this. So we can have a discussion about it. Any questions? And it's personal, isn't it? I mean, it's really personal what we believe and what we have a relationship with, yeah? Our bodies.
How does tantric yoga address things that are inherently not good?
It's a good question. They would, I would imagine, coming from that kind of philosophy would be, it's all a learning process. We've forgotten who we are. To some extent, there must be some forgetting in the understanding, I would imagine, that we've forgotten that we're all love. Somehow we've strayed from love. And so acts of violence or non-love would be that type of, I guess, forgetfulness, and this is just my understanding of it, and you're learning from it, and you're healing from it, hopefully, and karmically, you'll probably deal with it in some regards, and, yeah, to be forgiven, which I think, actually, the Yoga Sutras would probably feel the same way.
And you can better recognize good when you see something not good.
Yeah, like in a world of contrast, that's how you make preferences. And so I have a little bit of a law of attraction tie-in because I study that work. And that's part of that work too, is contrast. Contrast is really important to understand your preferences, like you just said, what you like, what you don't like, what you like, what you don't like, and hopefully you're following what you like. And that's unique to you, and unique to me, and unique to you, and unique to me.
Yeah, because there's the other part of the ego and the attachment to the idea of what's good and bad, and then actually committing acts of violence in the name of what you think is good on whatever the spectrum of violence is, and then going and then getting to that process of realizing what you've done and having your grief, you know, your regret, your grief, your suffering, your humbling, and then you're at the next level of understanding, like, whoa, this is like way beyond what I thought it was. I have so much less control, you know, that kind of like, yeah, and that's like next, another.
Yeah,
those layers of connecting
with
that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like the yamas and the niyamas are a confirmation, like the greatest hits, if you will, of what people have done over time that felt good and didn't feel good. Like, for example, I'll flip over to the yamas and the niyamas page in here. The yamas and the niyamas. So the first yama, ahimsa, non-violence, right? Pretty much know that that doesn't feel good in violence. Although, don't we have a real serious true history of violence as human beings? Holy moly, yes, right? we have satya, truthfulness, telling the truth. Usually keeps us on the up and up versus not so much, right? Ever get caught in a big lie and then have to spin it all over the place and fix it and then, oh my god, it's a whole big thing. If I just told the truth, it would have been a whole lot easier, even if it was a little bit painful at first, right? Asteya, non-stealing, to not steal, to misappropriate people's belongings. Even has in here not to steal people's possessions like their wives, possessions-wise. Yeah, you know, and again, things change over time, right? So you'll hear things in there that even like, you're like, oh, okay. Yeah, you don't possess people anymore, but asteya, not possessing people's coveted things, right? Stealing
them. And
stealing
time and energy.
Yes, that's the next one, brahmacharya. Not stealing people's energy, not stealing their time, how we leak our energy outside of ourselves, how we give up our power and our energy. Originally, in the Yoga Sutras, brahmacharya meant abstinence. Okay? Not leaking your sexual energy. But it's been actually kind of expanded over time to mean more like just energy in general, however you want to use your energy. It's not just sexual energy. Because energy is energy, right? So yeah, you have sexual energy, but you also have all sorts of other energy that you're harnessing and using. So how do we use our energy? Brahmacharya would say, harness it. You know, use it for something valuable. And that doesn't necessarily mean you can't have sex. So even that definition has changed over time. Okay. Aparigraha, non-attachment. This is saying the social restraint that teaches non-attachment, non-grasping, and non-possessiveness. It can be close to the non-stealing in a way, but this is more about, I always heard it as greed. This is like not being greedy, not taking too much. And as it relates in the sutra, it's more like material, like because the yogic way was less material. Now we live in a very material world, so it's kind of hard to say what this means in a way, because now everything's material in some regards. So does it mean, you know, give up your entire life and go on the street and be a sadhu? Well, some people are. You know, if you go to India, some people literally take this very literally. They're not attached to anything. They literally walk the streets. They don't live anywhere. They're in complete service to the divine in that they're just being a human being, and other people around them take care of them, right? Have you guys heard of the sadhus in India? They like walk around with a cup and literally in rows. That's it. Right? So, again, everything's open to interpretation, yeah.
I would love to follow along with you in the book.
Oh, I'm sorry.
If I knew where you were.
21. Oh, lines are so sweet and lovely and everything. So we're at, you said it was 21?
Based on Candace.
Candace is number one on the page.
It's number 6 also on that page. Sorry,
I didn't number my
mom's.
Number any blank pages.
Stop calling. I tried to turn that off.
Thank you.
And now it's
on this page 21.
Does that mean it's still recording?
Oh, it's been 6. It says 6 and 7.
Well, those are not right.
But up here, this is 21.
I don't know. I don't have my number.
Which one's 21? This one? I don't have my number.
Here, just go like 10 pages
with
in.
Emails.
Yes.
This one, the first page.
I can slow down if you want to take a minute as well. Do you want me to come over there and find it for you?
No, when we get Chica.
Oh, okay. So nonviolence, truthfulness, non-stealing, energy moderation, non-attachment or greed. And we could discuss these sometimes, you know, if you go into a sutra circle, we'll stick on one of these for weeks, just talking about what does brahmacharya mean, you know.
I got a niece that she's 24 now, but she's, you know, she got into yoga and stuff, like a real surface seeker, you know, but I don't know, she kind of left that behind, and then she wasn't really into it, like, especially when I first discovered Ashland, came here to visit. She was not into yoga at that time. She had been previously, but she had got out of it. And then she was living here, and she met somebody that comes here to visit frequently that lives in Chicago. They got together, and she ended up moving to Chicago. But what I'm bringing it up for is he's really into this Jesus thing, but thank God it's not extremely conservative like I pulled out of, but it's still like they think in terms of like I kind of thinking I left behind, so I can't. And she got into to this like a year ago, but she, you know, when she was talking to me the other day, she lives in Chicago now, but when we were talking on the phone and I was telling her I was a yoga teacher training, she says, you know, like that what she feels is that the Christianity, Jesus died for our sin, and that Jesus gives a moral code. And she said, I think that was lacking but in yoga, but I don't see it that way, you know, but I was just hearing her say that. But then, you know, now I'm learning like about this, and that's, I didn't really know anything to tell her at that time.
So
I just
did have a discussion and see what her moral code is and what you're learning about your moral codes. And again, everybody gets to interpret whatever they get to interpret. No judgment.
Well, my moral code is just trying to follow intuition. It's not like the Ten Commandments or this is you know, like I don't use the terminology sin.
And
she's gotten into using that, whereas it's kind of like
interpretation of life, right? I mean, this is the thing. It's like we're all in this together, trying to figure this out. You know, and so it's like just as much as she might judge yoga, we could also judge her. But like to really drop all the judgment and to just really begin the question. It's like, well, what are we doing? You know? And I like how you said that, intuition, right? I think we're all trying our best to be intuitive to the best of our capacity. Like if we could all follow our intuition, we are in a sense one collective mind, if you will. Like, right? Like we've figured out through quantum physics, and this is like such an interesting discussion now. 20 years ago, we didn't have all these discussions about quantum physics, which is now merging scientific knowledge with even stuff like this. This is only recent, right? In the last 10 years, or maybe 12 years or something, or 15 years, where it's like you see like one atom and the effect that that has on some other particle, like way across the universe, and like ripple effects and all these things. And so we are coming into a lot of knowledge right now, a lot of scientific exploration that's meeting some of the old philosophical Vedic 5,000 plus year old time information, right? Woo! It's exciting! It's like this new frontier where science and religion, if you want to call it religion, philosophies, whatever, are starting to understand the same thing.
Or Western stuff.
Yeah,
or
Western.
New science and old
science. New science and old science are coming
together.
Right. It's always been there, right? Yeah. Like this, some of this stuff has been around for a long time.
Yeah.
And we ignored it, or we didn't believe it, or we left it out, or whatever we did. And so I agree with you. It's like we're in the West waking up to being able to even hear the information.
Yeah.
That's been in existence, right?
Yeah.
And there's new information that is being frontiered that we did, that nobody knew, which is coming into alignment with this stuff too. It's like the law of attraction work and stuff, like really understanding, like, we're all affecting one another at a much deeper level than I think we actually really understood. And like on a major level, you know.
The science can be very heady.
Yeah.
And so if yoga is all about balance,
right,
and this is what brings us back into our bodies and up.
Yeah,
our
heads, right. Yeah,
More of the meaning and the richness of it, the color, and
is
versus just the black and white.
Right.
And science and math, which is all awesome, but we can get too wrapped up in it.
I agree. And it is interesting that the Yoga Sutras is a little bit scientific in that it does experiment. You know, science is a lot about experimenting, so it's giving you in the second chapter, not the first chapter, the first pada, samadhi pada, is about learning what samadhi is. Like, what is samadhi? What is bliss? Can we contemplate on that for a little bit? What are we teaching here? And then the second pada, which is where a lot of people spend their time, is sadhana pada. Sadhana means practice, your practice. You've probably heard that. Kundalini sadhana. You know, sadhana is our practices. So that's when they start to talk about this, the branches of yoga. Because these are actionable, and I'll put it in coaching terms, action items. These are actionable items that create some possibility of change in your life. This is things that we can actually do, right?
I like tools to support tapping into your intuition.
Yes.
So that you're actually clear.
Yeah. Exactly. Which brings us right to the niyamas.
And that's
the
yoga. To me, that's yoga.
Yeah.
They help you.
Tune
your instrument up. This being your instrument. Yoga tunes that instrument up.
It does. And so both of you just landed on the next thing, which is the niyamas, which is how do you tune your instrument up? Well, the first niyama is called sausha. Cleanliness. Cleanliness, purity. This is about cleaning up your body, your mind, your thoughts, your actions, maybe even the environment you live in. Do you guys have any experience like I do? If my house isn't clean, I can't think. It's just like a weird thing. Like I need a clean environment for myself to feel clean.
Yeah. Well, it feels good.
It feels like too much, right?
Yeah. And then when you have such a little space here in Ashland, and you've already given away tons of stuff, you know, then, but you can't live in clutter. I mean, or you don't want to.
Because it takes up energy,
right?
Anything that's taking up our energy, whether it's because clutter takes up mental energy. So it's about, this is why I think everything comes back to energy. This is just the way that I feel. You know, again, I'm just teaching what I know and what I'm feeling. But if we're talking about energy, it's cleaning up our energy, cleaning up our act, cleaning up our side of the street, cleaning up what we can control, right? So that we feel clean, vibrant, This goes into food. This is why a lot of yogis decide eventually to come off, and I'm not going to get on the high horse about meat, but a lot of people will stop eating meat, they'll stop eating processed foods, they'll stop eating a lot of the things that take up a lot of energy in your body. It's not because you're a bad person that you eat meat, or meat's a horrible thing. It just takes energy to digest it. So think about if you go to a yoga class and you eat a burger or you eat a salad. How do you feel in a twisting practice if you've eaten a burger or if you've eaten a salad? It's just that simple.
Depends.
But it's like, it's a lot to digest, right? Like, I ate a burrito one time and went to class, and I was like, why did I do that? It's such a big burrito. I'm so, I couldn't, like, do anything. I was like, oh, yeah. I had, like, all sorts of reflux and acid. And I'm just joking. But you know what I mean? It's like, so this is when people are practicing physical asana, it's easier on your body to be a bit empty, right? To be a bit cleaner. That's it. It's just about, like, energy, right? All right. And I don't want to have a whole discussion about food. I love all of you who eat meat. In fact, no judgment against it whatsoever. I love meat. I think it's great. Okay. Santosha. Contentment. That's the second one.
It's great.
I think it's great. You eat meat. Fantastic. Right? It's a choice.
Animals. We eat animals.
We eat animals, yeah. And animals eat animals, right? Like we're animals.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And I always wonder who's eating us. That's been my reaction to playing on labor.
The bacteria.
Like, who's actually eating us? I think about this thing. So contentment, supreme contentment. Wouldn't it be nice to just be content? This is one of the most powerful ones. Like, a lot of people are seeking this. To feel contentment. Just to feel content. That's a practice, a yogic practice. So if you, I used to joke about this in LA, because you get out of class, and then the fight to get to people's cars in parking lots to get out just knocked everybody out of their yoga practice, completely away from Santosha, into like wanting to basically kill each other. Dang. To get onto the highway, you know, you're just like, we almost practiced yoga, and now we're all giving each other the finger, and people are like, you know, like, I mean, it was like, it was so nuts, and I was like, where's the yoga in this, you know, and I question it myself, too. I watch the unraveling of that as I leave, you know, so we're human. This is our path. This is called being in yoga practice. All of this stuff. Yeah? You wake up in the morning and you're constantly with namaste. If you're in some sort of a yogic mindset, framework. Tapas, I like this zeal or austerity. It means in this book, discipline. Some people call it discipline. In some books you'll see tapas translated as heat building. It's practices, it's discipline, it's creating action, it's very action-oriented. And this says, teaching enthusiasm, effort, self-discipline, and heat, because it also is about burning out impurities. Tapas, the practice of vinyasa, is a tapas-building practice to burn out impurities in what's called dross, which is like the lethargy of energy in our system. So again, it's coming back to how we burn off the stuff that's just kind of stagnant in our bodies, stagnant in our lives. And can we approach our lives with effort and will and enthusiasm? And this ties to the chakras and energy centers as well. One of the other niyamas, I'm sure many of you do this because you're all seekers to some extent, and you probably wouldn't be in this room, is svadhyaya, or self-study. Svadhyaya is the practice of studying. In this context, in the Yoga Sutras, it's context of studying what would be called, what would we call these ancient wisdom teachings, we would call them spiritual study, austere texts because they, you know, they're revered, they're time-tested, right? So time-tested, revered, things like the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata and all these like different texts that are yogic classics. Right? So that's the study. Now, for me, Svadhyaya is like self-help books. I'm like a self-help book junkie. And I'm also like really into energy work, so I like all the energy books. That's my Svadhyaya. And the last one, Ishvara Pranidhana. And that's the ultimate surrender. Ishvara Pranidhana is translated to the Supreme or God or Bliss or maybe even Samadhi. And it's here it says Supreme God. So the ultimate surrender, the ultimate practice of letting go. Letting go of your mind, your body, this body, all attachments and everything, and absorbing into trust.
Is that what I meant to say?
Yeah.
Ishvara Pranidhana.
Pranidhana, to contemplate on the ultimate life force energy, the supreme light. So, that's beautiful, right? So that's a practice of surrendering. Let me think of all these things. Do these sound like things that you practice as yogis? Do you fall in step with some of this stuff? Naturally.
Hopefully as humans.
As humans, right?
Intention to do it.
We have some of these intentions, right? Whether or not we're doing them all the time is the practice. We're not perfect. Okay? So I'm always falling in and out of this stuff. But when I saw this, when I first started studying yoga, I was like, wow, I get all this stuff. So it wasn't like a shock or surprising to me. It was like, oh, okay, cool, I can do that, I can practice this stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's a framework, like everything else, a blueprint. Okay? Any questions about this stuff? I mean, we could contemplate on it, but let me go back to something, because there's something I want to point out that's really important. And it is, I saw it, and I don't want to glance over it, because it's probably one of the key points of the Yoga Sutras. Above our flower, above the eight limbs where we were earlier, it says, what's the purpose of yoga? You're going to hear a lot of different purposes of yoga over time. But it says then, to remove the veils. To remove the veils that hide the deepest layers of your being. Maharaji Patanjali, that's Patanjali, the author of the Yoga Sutras. Mahara is like the biggest, like Maha is the biggest rishi, the biggest seer, the biggest seeker. Maharishi Patanjali elaborated the eight limbs of yoga as Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi. These are the components of Raja Yoga, the royal path to union. Oh, and that was a Deepak Chopra quote. That's great. But to remove the veils, and I'm going to let you know what the veil is called. It's called avidya. Avidya. So you'll come across that word throughout your yoga path. Avidya means illusion or veil. And we're always, and the illusion is that what? What do you think that the illusion, the biggest illusion is that we're trying to transcend? And this is where it gets again, a little tricky to understand. Avidya. The illusion is
that we're separated.
Yes.
We're different from one another.
You just said that we're separate. And so it's in interesting, right? Because the Yoga Sutras will say, right, that we are in a dualistic, not dualistic environment. We're all nature trying to transcend to Ishvara Pranayama or to surrender to Ishvara Pranayama. The underlying illusion of all of it is that we're separate. It's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it? It sounds that way, right? It's like, wait, but you said there were two things, and we're transcending this thing to get to this thing. And there is a part of this philosophy that says, well, the whole thing is actually really an illusion. To really stick it together. So in a sense, it's a non-dual philosophy, but in the end, it sounds quite not, it's a dualistic philosophy that sounds actually quite non-dual, mm-hmm. if you were to really think about it.
Yeah.
We're transcending the illusion of vidya of separation to get to wholeness, or to remember, this is a common phrase that people use now in New Age thought, to remember our wholeness, that we just forgot. We're actually one big living whole organism that's all part of one thing. Very possible, right?
Very probable.
And what's interesting, if you look at kind of like quantum physics or like the Matrix, I love the movie The Matrix. Going into the Matrix, like the Matrix is a simulation. Everything in that movie is about, is kind of almost what this is in a way. Whoever did the Matrix is a very spiritual person, as you could imagine. Because if you think about what they're talking about, that everything's a simulation, is similar to this, that it's saying everything that we're doing is one big game, it's one big cosmic joke, it's one big illusion, and it's a dream that we've all dreamt to keep ourselves occupied, but really we're just one thing. It's just one thing having a show. And the Matrix kind of alludes to that. We're going to take the red pill, the blue pill, go down the rabbit hole, what that means. You know? It's interesting.
Very probable.
Right?
Yeah.
It is probable. And that each one of us is just this creative being that is dreamt up because there's infinite possibilities of creativity.
I kind of think of us like as one body. You know, like if a body has a leg and an arm and a nose, I kind of think of like we're all parts of the same body.
Yeah. Right. And like some lenses would say that one body is the earth. Right? Some would say, right? So that depends on what we believe. Right? What do you believe?
And what do you discover?
And what do you discover?
I mean, sometimes when we say what do you believe, it sounds so concrete as opposed to being open to the possibility. But
that's what I like. That's what I like.
That itself can be shifted and changed over and enhanced and.
Yeah. That's what I'm. Yeah, it's like the living question, right?
Not a set of beliefs or religion or you know, but just
yeah,
open.
Yeah,
to discover life.
Yeah,
it would explain the profound impact of connectedness or aloneness on the human experience when you don't feel connected.
Right.
Why would we feel so profoundly awful when you're not connected, or vice versa. When you connect with someone, it feels amazing.
Right.
It does make you start to wonder, you know, how separate really are we?
Yeah.
How important is this?
That's
you know,
right.
It's more important than you think.
Yeah. And for like some people, the connection could be like a spiritual connection. If they find a spiritual connection, they feel home too, right? So there is that. It's like all this energy. Yeah, it's fascinating.
What Nicole actually just said is that people find oneness and connectivity in religion as well.
So in their spiritual practice.
Yeah.
And then a lot of people gather around an idea, and that becomes a religion.
We
do it in all sorts of ways.
Yeah. When I go to church, which has been a long time, but I used to go to this little Baptist church in Eagle Point. And I loved it because everybody was like 90 years old. But everybody is just so sweet there, and it's just like a room full of love for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
that's been there for 20 years, you know. So I just feel like it just depends on what it is you're searching for.
Yeah, right.
You know, and where you're looking for, because you can find it in lots of different places.
Right, yeah.
Nice.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I like to, the connection between these and the asanas, just to bring it back to that.
Mm-hmm.
For me, like, I don't know the names very well, but it's non-attachment, was it pratyahara?
Are you talking about the limbs?
No, the limbs.
Yeah, pratyahara, sense of job. Is that what you're talking about?
Sense of
Parigraha.
And ahimsa, non-violence, like all of that, all of, for the most part, that applies across the core of what religion is.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If we look beyond the differences, if we look beyond the greed and the power stuff that's gone on, how religion has been used, blah 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 blah. At the core, it's got that. And so, like, when you're on the mat, I mean, really, when you're using your body in anything, but there's a meditative thing to yoga. And there's that intention inside of it, you know, where you can bring your religion, you can bring that love to the mat, and then you can go, am I being violent with myself right now? Am I beating up on myself for not being able to achieve what I think that person should, you know? Am I being greedy because I want to look like that, and I want that butt, and I want those boobs, you know, all that stuff? Am I being attached to an idea of what I think I'm supposed to be, or how I think you're supposed to be? All of that, like, it's present when you're working inside your own body and your own energy, you know, and so that's what I think is cool.
I love that.
Like,
and that's how you can share.
Connection. Yeah.
That's exactly how you can share. When you're teaching on the mat, with your students, that's how you share it. It's just that. Like, today, my theme is a parigraha. It's non-attachment, non-greed. What am I coveting inside my own body today that feels maybe judgmental or greedy, or like I'm wanting too much out of myself or somebody else?
Yeah.
And how would that look on the mat? You know, it's an interesting inquiry, and to bring that kind of information into a class is really smart. It's really intelligent, you know. Today we're practicing ahimsa, non-violence, and every pose I really want you to not push yourself to the nth degree, to slow down, to take care of your body, you know, however you want to implement it. Today's going to be, we'll practice purity. Is it purity of thought? Challenge yourself during this class that when you're in each pose, not to beat yourself up about not getting a pose, but to be pure to your heart and your mind. What would that kind of a practice be like, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's good ideas. And, you know, it's like, there's a lot of ways that you can share some of the basic sutra model, framework, blueprint, however you want to call it. Philosophy, science, devil's work, however you want to share it. These are ways that you can share, really wise. And there are paired terms, and maybe we'll do this in another class, but there are paired terms throughout the whole Yoga Sutras like that, that work together. They're called, like, I think that's what people call them these days, like paired terms. Like, I think I was telling you guys, like, Sukha and Stira. Sukha is like, in every pose, you want to feel pleasure and steadiness and ease. Sukha and Stira. Then there's one that's like Abhyasana Vairagya. Abhyasana means consistent practice. Vairagya means non-attachment, a different non-attachment, but essentially the same thing, which is being diligent and consistent and enthusiastic with your practice, but not getting attached when something's not happening. Let it go.
Like when
it's okay to drink at Vipassana today. Right,
and I'm not doing this.
Right, and walking out mad because we hate retreat.
Well, I just go home and I do it, and I was like, oh, of course you can do it here. Stupid.
And did you curse God while you're
at it? She's like, I'm going to surrender, right?
Yeah.
Surrender.
Even as a teacher, not becoming attached, if, like, for instance, you've made a plan and you realize that nobody in the class is going to get there.
Right.
You know, you get halfway there and you just change your plan and not be attached to the result. Well, we have to make it to here because that's what I thought.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly that. So there are these throughout the whole Yoga Sutras. You'll see there are terms like that that kind of are paired together for that specific reason. Again, a little bit of this dualistic avenue. Like, I'm going to give you this thing, but then I want you to also counter it. It could actually be like counter-posing,
Yeah, like forward and backward.
Yeah, and you don't overdo anything. It is, in a sense, a little bit of a middle path also of Buddhist philosophy, which is why a lot of Buddhists are yogis and yogis are Buddhists. It is the middle way, the middle path in many regards. Okay, so I wanted to allude to those. That took about an hour. And so we have another hour. So let's, I'm glad we did that actually. It's good to have that framework. And then you do have it actually in here. So let's go to, there's another space in your book in the manual that is. Is everyone awake? Do you need a little tea break? Just so you know what we talked about, the tantra versus the dualism, non-dualism, there is some interesting stuff in the manual. It's just a few pages, but that kind of talks about what we talked about. And so if you want to go a little bit deeper, it's in there.
What's the heading?
It actually says philosophies, key concepts.
Okay.
Just so you know, it's in here.
Okay.
And it says things about tantra, the yoga sutras, going deeper, Patanjali yoga sutras, how to connect the chakras to the philosophies, which actually I'm going to do a little bit now, dualism, realizing God, some fundamental concepts of karma. And then it does tell you creation stories. And I alluded to this today, which is interesting that they have it down as a creation story. I've never heard it this way, but I like it. So you're always learning as a yogi, always. Is the concept of Purusha and Prakriti, Purusha being the soul god, as I was telling you, the oversoul, and Prakriti being nature. Then they have Tantra, Shiva, and Shakti. You've probably heard of these terms. Shiva is Godhead, Shakti is creative life force, and it's what it means. Some people say it's feminine energy and masculine energy. But that's the creation story of Tantra. So you can kind of see it as that, which is interesting.
But is Tantra
right.
Because
if it's as a creation story, then it's similar to actually the Patanjali sutras because it's two concepts. It's Shakti meeting Shiva, transcending into, they merge into oneness, and so it's union. And so it is kind of similar because if you have Prakriti nature and you have Supreme Ishvara, you're transcending them to come to oneness. There's still duality going into non-dual. I don't know, it's interesting. It says, according to Tantra, the male principle is Shiva, female principle is Shakti. They're unified on a plane of infinite consciousness beyond the earthly concept of space and time.
Mm-hmm.
It's really similar. To create our universe, they were separated and then they combined and became one. That's the creation story.
So Nicole, do you know this obviously is off of like a website because it has like all of this and you're like,
Teacher Central.
Oh, that's what that is. Okay. So like you wanted to like actually click on something that's like tools for such.
I don't know. I think she bought this like training set of manuals from them, which is why it says Yoga Teacher Central on it.
Okay.
And so the clickable links, I'm not sure if you have to actually buy it or not. Mm-hmm. Like I don't know. I haven't done that.
Okay.
But what's interesting is what I was saying about these manuals is Yoga Teacher Central is really it's like a library of resources. So they're taking stuff from a lot of different places and mm-hmm. merging it into like a resources kind of library. So it's not just her training. It's like a combination of lots of different things. Like you'll see Deepak in here, and you'll see Doug Keller, and you'll see lots of different people's Judith Lasseter, lots of different yogis stuff. It combined in here.
Yeah.
Okay. So then it goes right after the creation stories, it starts to talk about energy, power, and life force. And this is why I think it's inevitable that you have the discussion of energy, because energy is what we're made of. of. And even if you just believed in the energy, you could still believe a lot of these concepts. They're relevant to some degree. So here it talks about solar and lunar prana, solar being masculine, lunar being feminine. And if you were to look at your own body, we have a central column of energy. The central column of energy is called Shushumna Nadi. And Shushumna, and actually, do I have a picture in here? Some yogic texts have it's in Wheels of Life, so I'll show it to you. Wheels of Life is my fave Bible of energy chakra systems. And I'm just going to, that's a really cool picture in here, so I'm going to show you. Okay, this one.
What book is that?
It's called Wheels of Life.
Oh.
It's by a woman named Anadia Judith. And she, I believe, now lives in Hawaii. She used to live in Marin. She might still live in both places. I'm going to give you a couple of pictures of this. Shivan Shakti, okay, this one. Please. Okay. This is a famous ancient Hindu drawing. You'll see this a lot in different yogic teacher trainings, and I've seen this picture by so many people at this point. This is a picture, you guys can all come around if you want to, of what was prescribed as all the energy lines, the nadis, the energy pathways, and the chakras. Okay. So you've got your different channels, right? So when we study things like acupuncture, right, Chinese medicine, they talk about all these meridian lines. I should have brought my other book. I'll bring it next time. It's called Energy. No, I'll say it's called Energy Medicine. Maybe something
like that. Are you talking about like the 12 meridians?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Cindy. No, it might not be that. But there are all the meridians mapped out in the body.
Mm-hmm.
They have maps in it. It's really cool. But this is the ancient Hindu text. And so it is said that we have 72,000 nadis, energy pathways in our body. How do we know that we have 72,000? I made it up. I have no idea. But there's a lot, right? Think about like all the blood vessels and all the nerves in your body and everything that's going on inside of you. There's probably a whole lot. You probably took a little segment of the body and then just multiplied it. But then they drew this. So this is a famous drawing. People see this and they're like, whoa, what's that? This is what they were using when they were doing their work. You know, in our healing work, we have things that are like more like meridian points and things like that.
That's a massage you learn, the 12 meridians, which are associated with your organs.
Yes. So the organs, this is one lens, and again, you'll see a couple of different ones. It's primarily the same, but in the book that I have now, we'll take about 6 or 7 different kinds of energy programs, like the Kabbalah and acupuncture, Chinese medicine, Reiki, yoga, and they kind of show you all of them. So there's some of them are slightly different. But what's cool is the chakras are based off of where all the endings, the nerve endings, stop, where a lot of them combine and conglomerate. And so that's how you get these points of energy that have a lot of energy. So you've got the 7th chakra being the crown, 6th chakra right by the eyes, right, the ocular area. You've got the throat chakra and all the the bronchial, right? The heart, right? The solar plexus, our sacral chakra, and then the first chakra, the base of the spine, essentially. So this is one view of that, where the nerve ganglia is. And then we've also got one that's around the organs, like this. So, and this is sometimes in different books switched, but the pineal and the pituitary gland, right, you might see that opposite in certain books. But these are two very important points in our system. Chakra 5, the thyroid gland. Yeah. Chakra 4, in this lens, would be different because most people would say, well, it's the heart. And here they're saying it's the thymus and the adrenals, which is interesting for 3. But, you know. And then these two, ovaries, and then the testes. And, or the base of the spine. So this is another way that, people can look at it. Traditionally, in most Hindu yogi, based off of the same thing, all these different depictions, you've got root, sex organs, navel center, heart center, third eye, and crown. It's divided in half. This is called the Shushumna Nadi, this long central channel of energy that goes up and down the spine. The spine is your communication highway.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the left and the right side. So we're looking, she's in my direction. The left side of your body is the Ida. The Ida is your feminine essence, your feminine side, your feminine energy. And the right is the Pingala, and that's your masculine energy. Lunar, solar. And there's many different overlays to all of that, but basically yin energy, yang energy. So we can talk about opposites. Yeah, Shiva Shakti, right?
Mm-hmm.
Shiva Shakti in the tantric tradition, Shakti in the Kundalini would be that coiled snake of energy that's residing at the base of the spine. That slithers up these chakras, opening the chakras to get to Godhead or Shiva energy. Kundalini awakening. Got it. So the Kundalinis, that's what they're working with. That's their lens. They're like, let's get this energy moving up and open up all our chakras, right? Put the energy flowing. Notice it looks like almost like a pulley system. It kind of works that way. It's like as one opens, it affects the other one. So one's spinning in one direction, then one's spinning in the other direction. Just like a pulley system, right? If you're pulling something up a pulley, we've got the gears and the rope, and it's moving like this, okay?
It's also what the DNA looks like.
It's awesome. That's right. That's right. It's exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And let's see what else I want to say about that right now.
How she just drew her standing on the side.
Yeah,
she stands like me. Yeah, I love that.
It's kind of like a weird posture.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, attitude, a little hunched over, a little kind of cockeyed.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just like,
yeah.
She's not awake yet.
I'm like that too. We're all a little bit cockeyed. So then you've got these depictions, right, and all the different petals going to eventually the Sahasrara, it's hard to say, the thousand-petaled lotus, which is infinitely unfolding with infinite amounts of petals. That is basically what that depicts. It's like the flower of life, it's just like eternal, just like constantly goes, right? So there's different overlays of this. I don't know this information that well. I'll just be really honest. I've never really quite learned all the sacred geometry aspects of this.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, it's sacred geometry too. And there's all sorts of reasons why this exists as well.
Uh-huh.
And there's stories behind all of them.
Uh-huh.
So
throughout.
And the stories behind them, I'll just show you that, see if there's another depiction. In Hindu mythology, you'll see, I don't have it on that one. Things like this. In like, let's say, in each one of these, there might be, I'm just trying to look at here, 6 chakra? No, this is what?
That's the
Shiva.
5. Same one, right?
No, this is actually throat chakra. But see how there's symbols, there's animals, there's sacred geometry, there's symbols within that. And each one, like, this says goddess, there's goddesses and gods, archetypes within each symbol. This stuff gets really deep.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's a whole body of knowledge that I'm not completely aware of. But I do know about the energy centers, but I don't know so much about the Hindu overlays and the stories.
Mm-hmm.
There are people, bhakti yogis, study the stories. that's part of their devotional yogi. And they're bhakti yogis that can tell you every story about Hanuman and Bharati and Radha and Krishna. And it's fascinating stuff. It's fascinating.
The elephant is supposed to help us in the process.
Yeah,
what they're designed for to help us focus on the aspects of ourselves and that clearing.
Exactly. Yeah. So these stories are really cool to learn. And as you learn them, that it's really interesting stuff too. So this stuff is deep. It's so deep. I mean, you could study this stuff for your whole life and just still be like, oh my God, I learn something all the time. New, all the time. So I wanted to show you those pictures because that's what we're talking about, spinning the chakras, right, as the result of polaric currents. This is telling you there's different polar energies, right, sun and moon. And we'll talk about what each one represents. I love this one. This one of my favorite pictures. Look at that. Is that hilarious? But what it's showing you is the magnet, there's a magnetic current. Mm-hmm. That's between us, right? As human beings, you were talking to us and moving to this, right? It feels really good to be in polarity. One person is giving energy, one person is receiving energy, but we feel that on a sexual level, on a heart level. And so that's what we're talking about, energy. Yeah. Then there's all sorts of tables that you'll see these everywhere in different places. Again, so much information, but these will say things like, chakra, the Sanskrit name, the meaning, the location, the element related to it, the energy state related to it, the psychological state, identity, how we orient to ourselves, right? Colors, sounds, vowels, planets, metals, gemstones.
Wow.
What's the name
of that author of that book?
Her name is Anodia Judith. She's a PhD. I don't know how you become a PhD of the chakra system, but she became a PhD of her own chakra system. She wrote the Bible, this, and then she wrote this book too, which I brought in, which I love as well. And I don't refer to it as much, but I'm going to start reading it because I opened it and I'm like, ooh, there's some juicy information in here. Eastern body, Western mind. And it combines some of the Eastern philosophy with the Western mental therapeutic overlay. But what it does in this body of work, can you turn on the light?
You want me to?
Sure. Yeah, could you? I thought maybe that was what you were doing. Is it talks about body types. And you learn a lot about this with Reiki, is looking at people's bodies because it tells a lot about their energy. And this then translates also to Ayurveda.
Yeah.
Because Ayurvedic body types, if you know a little bit about Ayurveda.
Yeah, that's all right.
Okay. Like
did you see me going like this?
I know. So I mean Ayurveda, the doshas, right? And if you don't know anything about Ayurveda, I'm not going to get deep into it, but there's profiles. They're called doshas. You're either fiery, pitta, you're either really airy, which is vata, or your kaphic, which is more earth and more grounded. The body types in Ayurveda is what they talk about all the time. Because a vata person generally looks like me. Wiry, thin, frail, they like to call it frail. air. Like we're just like, hummingbird, that's why I talk like that. That's vata. That's super vata. Kapha is a little bit thicker boned, denser body, a lot more like legs, right? Like they're like in the earth.
Bigger
eyes.
Muddy.
Yeah, thick hair, like really glossy, thick hair. So they're earth, mud, earth, dense. So, right? And then you've got fire, who are the people who are like, hear me roar for the Leo, like, whew, you know, and they're sweaty, and they're like really in their bodies, strong, angry, is that what we said?
I was going to say active or driven.
They can be
competitive.
Also, yes, competitive, a little bit aggro, really intense.
That sounds like me.
Right?
That sounds exactly like me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe you're
and you have skin.
Just like a little bit more intense, because it can have like
stresses there, stuff your skin.
Yeah, acne, rashes, redness.
Heat sensitivity,
yeah, they get hot really easily, hot flashes. Then you have, so those are like the three, let's say, main profiles, and then you can be a combination of all of them. You can be tri-dosha, which I know you are, which is like a pain in the butt. How do I manage those of all three? Most people are dual dosha. But the point being of all that digression is that in this book they talk about body types. You know, if you, I mean, this might be obvious, but if somebody's like this, how do you think they feel in their heart?
Heavy.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's like, that's like the obvious. Mm-hmm. Is that? Because if they weren't, they'd be showing their heart. Right? So there's some sort of protection happening or vulnerability happening. And that doesn't mean that's happening for everyone. I mean, maybe they're just tired and
they're just tired of being the tallest person in the room.
But yeah. There's a closing that's happening.
Do you say type or expression?
Just like an expression.
Yeah.
So it's like you can kind of deduce a little bit about that person. Like, mm-hmm.
Nice.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So these are quick ways that if you're in a classroom and you're a teacher, you can kind of start to like look at body types and see, energetically, I wonder if there's something going on with that person. And you can feel in a room too, ooh, that person doesn't want to be touched. You ever have that experience in a room where you're like, right? And now that can be your own protection mechanism. Or you can just really sense, like, that person is closed off, they probably don't want me touching them, and I got it, it's cool, you know? This is just ways you can start to read energy and read bodies, start to learn this information and start to learn about maybe what's going on energetically for people so that you can be more attuned to them in a class. Do you have to know this stuff? No, but it's interesting. You know? So that's why I'm not going too deep into it. But what's a little bit more interesting, I think, is just knowing the basic shots, like what are they and how we develop through them and how this might affect your own system. And right, as teachers, we're really teaching what we know about ourselves most of the time, right? Like, oh, I get this in my body, and therefore I like to teach it. Like, you're going to teach a different way than you're going to teach. So, in almost every body of work around the chakras, they would say that you develop these chakras until you're 8 years, about 8 years old, between 7 and 8. And then there are some people say that you're still developing chakras over time. And I think that I feel like we are opening our chakras and developing our chakras as part of our evolution constantly. Because we're always learning, like we were talking about earlier, and things are shifting, things are changing. That being said, in your early formative years of life, you are developing a lot. Most of what we do is come in as a sponge, a clean slate, and then you get handed program after program after program after program after program. And we're like, this is how I'm supposed to operate, right?
Would anybody argue with that?
No, that's hard to get rid of the nonsense.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
Well, at that point, you don't have discernment yet. You haven't been taught discernment.
Mm-hmm.
Your life teaches you discernment, right? So it's really interesting. It's like, okay, now we come in as this clean slate. Let's say we come in as spiritual energy. We come in as crown point zero. Some would say, well, we also come in with some samskaras. Samskaras are our tendencies, which is our karma.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have some stuff, if you believe in that, life after life.
Epigenetics, even.
Epigenetics, that's right. Having some gene markers and things like that.
That your DNA is impacted by what's happened to your predecessors. So
mm-hmm.
Particularly like transgenerational trauma, typically,
mm-hmm.
It can be passed down.
Oh,
and so you're experiencing in your body something that really is related to something your grandmother went through.
Mm-hmm.
Even what you experienced today, what you have for lunch, what hair
right.
changes your
right.
expression on a day-to-day basis.
Right. Our environment,
yeah.
always, always things.
Yeah.
Well, that's
you can flip genes on
her. Goes to counseling, and she just had her counselor tell her that, like, you know, what you're dealing with may not even be yours.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So it's complicated.
Yeah.
It's really tricky. What's fascinating about this as a framework is it talks about our development in a way that I think explains a lot about who we are, and it explains a lot about yoga. Because, so for example, a good example, so we can look at this if you want to. So the first chakra, zero, let's say, or birth can even have its own chakras, right? Birth to like one. Essentially, some books would say one and a half, is your primary, it's called Muladhara, and you know, you can find this stuff in books, so whether or not you want to write it down or not, I don't know, but let me see if it's in your book here. The koshas are in your book. The chakras are not. Chakras for an entire workshop, okay? So just letting you know, like, I'm not going
to
go too deep.
I'm not doing that.
But Muladhara. Mula means root. So it's our root relationship, the first chakra, okay?
What's the name, Muladhara?
Mula, it's not in there. Hold on a second. I apologize. I will show, you can look at this. I'll tell you when I'm telling you this stuff too, how it relates to yoga. Okay? Chakra one. Earth. Our roots. Ground. What part of our bodies do you think would relate to this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's why I find this to be interesting too. If we want to do a grounding practice, we do things on our feet and in our legs.
Okay.
Right? And, or, we touch the ground. Poses that are touching the ground are grounding. We're touching the earth. It's about basic needs being met, survival. If you have birth trauma, you're going to have a lot of fear, probably. Because you didn't know if you were going to survive. Basic needs are also our food, water, it's matter, it's the beginning. So much of how we came into this world does affect us, even though we don't remember it, it does affect us.
Mm-hmm.
If you were taken from your mother when you were born and put in an ICU unit and not come out for a couple months, that affects you. Whether or not you remember it or not, your primal relationship to your mother is separated. So this affects our energy. Our energy can be positive or negative at any chakra. And I just mean positive and negative, not meaning good or bad, but just being either, it can be overactive, balanced, or underactive. So I'm just saying positive and negative, like a battery that has two charges.
Like where the two dual, the solar and the lunar needs.
Yes, solar and lunar. You can be depleted or receiving in one chakra, you could be over, you could be pitta. This is where like Ayurveda could come, you could be like pitta in a chakra, or more like kapha in a way in a chakra. It's like, it's just when I'm talking about energy and I say positive and negative, I'm talking about like two ends of a battery. Right? I'm not talking about one is bad and one is good. I'm just saying its energy has a charge. Okay? And in Prakriti, there's something that you'll hear down the road called the gunas. The gunas are just that. It's like proton, neutron, electron. Positive, negative, neutral.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's never a good and a bad. It's always just energy. Positive, negative, neutral. Okay. We gave it the labels. Alright. So yeah, so grounding, survival. This can be issues or I don't feel safe in the world, so I can't trust. I have a lot of fear in my body. What else do I want to tell you about that? So yeah, legs, body parts, legs, feet, bones. That's as deep as I'm going to get with this stuff right now. Okay. And again, each of these is a chapter. Chakra 2. Sacral chakra. Sex organs. Right, if it relates to organs. Svadhisthana. You don't have to write all these. You could probably get this book, or you could. But Svadhisthana means sweetness. Lower abdomen, genitals, and womb. This is the water chakra. So you go from earth to water. What do you think that the water element of your energy, what do you think that's about? Just out of curiosity, do you know anything about this sex chakra? Emotions. It's emotional energy, yeah. Water is all about emotions. Mm. Like, also, because it's the sex chakra, I shouldn't call it the sex chakra, because it's not healthy to have sex at all. It's the sacral chakra. but sex is part of it. It's desire, pleasure, sweetness. The reason why people say sex is because it's the sex organ, the glands of the organs, the ovaries, the testes.
Is that the creativity?
Yeah. Creativity. Procreation. Yeah. Creative energy. Shakti energy. Highly creative. The imbalance, if you were to put it in those terms, the imbalance would be something like shame.
Mm-hmm.
So like root chakra's fear and trust issues, survival issues, safety mm-hmm. issues. The second chakra is more like shame, guilt. It's where we harbor those feelings. And people relate a lot to sex because there's a lot of sexual shame in our culture. It's not so much, sexual shame in a lot of cultures, mm-hmm. actually. I mean, there's a lot of suppression in sexuality in a lot of cultures. Okay. What do you think is how it relates to the body in yoga, for example? What would be an example? I was saying there's the imbalance in chakras, like shame and guilt, a lot of sexual shame.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of sexual suppression, which is why as a culture we're very sexually suppressed, which is where a lot of this stuff comes from, Catholic suppression of this energy. Because you know what? It's powerful energy, right? You're with a partner, your husband, you've been with him forever. You know how powerful sexual energy is. It's how we connect. It's magnifying. There's infinity. It's really powerful. That's what creates babies.
I listen to a podcast.
Hello, it creates humans.
Yeah.
Powerful energy.
I listened to this podcast from the psychotherapist Esther or something. She grew up in Belgium, maybe? But her parents fled Poland during World War II. And she was saying that in growing up like in Europe, in most countries, there's not a sexual suppression. And so like countrywide, you'll see that individuals typically don't have sex for the first time until they're in their early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like you have to do it with somebody that you love.
Mm-hmm.
There's less pregnancies, early pregnancies, or unwanted pregnancies.
Mm-hmm.
It was really interesting. I was like,
yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah,
it's just educating. It's just talking about what your body's capable of instead of just abstinence, you know, so people are just ignorant and having sex.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Exposing themselves to things that they, you know, and then look at all the things that happen. If you're saying all the unwanted pregnancies
mm-hmm.
and all the diseases,
mm-hmm.
you know, sexual diseases, all that. Right?
Yeah.
They're curious, so they're doing it, but you could tell them about it, and then they'll go, okay, I can wait.
Right. Yeah. In health ed class, really quick, I saw a sex ed videos from maybe Belgium and also Scandinavia, and it was amazing. It was like nothing like we've ever gotten
right.
here, where literally you're seeing two young people being friends.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And they're showing you that it's just a natural extension
of the friendship
and
yep.
trust and connection and being
oh,
able to
wow.
talk to each other. And then you're just like exploring together, and you know, so it just totally takes away
yeah.
all. You know, it's not like
yeah.
yeah.
In high school, they showed us in health class the movie Four Keeps with Molly Ringwald. Like, this is what will happen if you are a teenager
oh
that gets pregnant.
I don't know.
Oh,
yeah.
She's just
going
to keep it.
Keeps it.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
It's like,
I remember
that's
some
weird
ear time. I was shown a birth video.
Oh, God.
And I remember screaming and running because this woman was screaming at the top of her lungs and there was blood everywhere. And we were like, and I remember being like, I'm never having children ever in my entire life. I was scared to death.
Right.
Yeah. Oh my God. Can you imagine?
I saw my sister give birth and then I'm like, nope.
Oh,
no. Nope.
I thought having a difficult second child is great. Procreation, protection for the first child.
Yeah,
they
right.
go, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's fascinating. Okay, so that's, so I feel, you know, I feel that's the second child. Okay. This is also, I mean, we go really deep, but it also relates to balance, masculine and feminine energy. So the root chakra, you're talking about primal relationship. For most people, it's mother. It's not for everybody, but for most, it's mother. And then the second chakra is when father comes into the picture. It's not that he was never in the picture, because
mm-hmm.
he is for some people, not for everybody, for some. But because the baby is usually eating off of and surviving off of the mother, the father relationship comes second, traditionally. Okay. There's always exceptions to the rule. So the second chakra around age 2, I actually saw this very viscerally with my own kid. Around 2.5, he didn't want anything to do with me, it was all about that. I was like, oh, and of course it took it personally until I was like, wait, remember your chakras, right? Because it's like, oh, he's got a developed relationship with a masculine, he's a boy, so that makes total sense. So he like very, very vividly cut it off and was like, I'm all about dad. And I was like, oh, okay, you got mom and dad there. The third chakra is solar energy. This is the energy of fire. So we go from primary relationship, earth, second relationship, water, mother-father, masculine, feminine, and now it's relationship to self. So it's interesting because it goes from externally orienting towards like survival and like meeting my parents to then, what am I all about? You know, fire, power, autonomy. This is the epitome of my son right now. I've been tracking him through the chakras. This has been a wild experience. All
start
about
will,
independence. They just want to do it. I can do that myself, Mom. You get so mad at me. Why are you telling me to do that? I can do it myself. Three. Metabolism, transformation, self-esteem. This is where we're gaining our confidence. And so I know, like, just personal example of transparency, my mom was, like, scared of everything. So, like, I was never allowed to do anything by myself because she would freak out. Couldn't handle it. Right? So then I grow up thinking, well, I gotta listen, you know, I gotta do everything that my parents tell me to the letter, and I became like a total perfectionist. And like, it was kind of a little bit powerless,
mm-hmm.
you know, coming from my power over life
mm-hmm.
as I heal these things. It's interesting, you know, to like really look at the philosophies that are around you, how you grew up, what you were around, what kind of people you were around, what cults you were in. Right? What your orientation was based on your environment. Okay, so this is interesting to know. So our power, what do you think? So we went from, we did body being feet and legs, being grounding, base chakra, to feeling and emotions in the second. What good postures could you do for that? Emotions and feeling in the second chakra. If you want to think of your body as going up,
forward and back, backwards and forward folds?
Yeah, I could see that. I would probably put those more in the heart, but you are folding from the hips. Hips.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so first chakra is the base chakra. Everything from that down is considered
good for that chakra. Hips, right below the navel center, this is your second chakra. It's the water. Pelvis translates to basin. Pelvis looks like a bowl of energy, water. We can tip our bowl forward anteriorly or tip it backwards posteriorly. Hips is all about the water. So if you want to do like a water class, a watery class, you'd be like, oh, hips, yin. That's why yin is such a good practice, because it's so much hip opening and we have so much crap to let go of in our hips.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Oh, we've been working on it. 2 years
we are
now.
Tight in our hips. Woo! And what's great about this book too is they give you little like exercises in here, there's meditations in here. So now I'm in third chakra. So anything that's at the navel center, right? So navel center, solar plexus. So anything where I'm bending, that's kind of what you were talking about, maybe. Belly prone. Belly postures where your navel is against something, or core. Core and twisting is great for third chakra. If you're angry during the day, do a bunch of core work. If you're not feeling your power, do a bunch of planks. You know?
Breath of fire.
Breath of fire.
Yeah.
Doesn't it just make you feel so strong?
Yeah.
I'm always like, rah! You know, I get like so energized and willpower from that. Yeah. And it brings on your solar energy. It is more masculine. But the fire will bring on the masculine energy of will, enthusiasm, motivation.
Right? Even though when like a powerlifter is going to do something before they hit their bar, they oftentimes will twist,
yes,
in something, and then they, you know, do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Chakra 4, Anahata. Anahata means unstruck, which is the heart. The sound without striking. Union.
Huh?
Anahata translates to unstruck. The sound that two things make without striking. Union. Isn't that cool? It's one of my favorite definitions of anahata. So, union. This is about creating balance. It's the air quadrant. So there's a lot of maps and overlays on the chakras too. Chinese medicine, like fire, water, I'm sorry, earth, water, fire, air, lightness. It's about communion. Hi, community. But in terms of your own personal being, it's love. Sacral chakra, sexual energy, magnetism, and attraction. Heart, different. It's about loving the tribe. It's about loving and friendship. It is about relationships, too, but not to be confused with sexual energy. This is like transcending sexual energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like more like loving yourself, loving others, acceptance, compassion.
Divine
love. Yeah, more like divine love. Not to say you couldn't reach that state with your partner.
No.
They go hand in hand. I love, touch. So this one, back bends, heart openers. Things that open up your chest, your shoulders. That makes sense. Then, look at this picture. I love this picture. This is funny. It's a picture of basically, so it's like an energy line that's going like this. It's connecting on the chakras to the heart. It's just
mm-hmm.
a funny picture. Because we can go, when we talk about the bodies, which we'll have to get to in another class, but it's the way that air or energy travels. It can travel up and down, around the navel, out from you, out. It can be dispersed everywhere. So we'll talk about the ways of, it's called cosmic energy, the values can go. And there's so much in it, I'm like, freaking out about that. Okay, so then we go to the throat, the Shuddha chakra. The Shuddha means purify, to purify. And this one is about, what do you think?
Truth.
Speaking your truth. Yeah, speaking your voice.
What was the first thing? Oh, purifying.
Purifying. Self-expression, honesty. So we go from earth to water to fire to air to
ether.
Ether. Ether. But also, in this case, yeah, speech, right? So like words have energy, right?
You call them that throat chakra, ether.
Yeah. So we're gonna go over to this one. Look at this, what they have in here. Remember this pose? You guys know this pose? Fish pose. Shoulder stands, things that stimulate the thyroid gland. They have in here, I'm sorry, that was for, oh no, that's right. Well, it's both. It's both. It's for the heart. But you can also do those for the fifth chakra as well. Ether, sound, vibration, I like that word, communication, mantras as a practice, really using your voice as a practice to clear your energy, telepathy, they're saying here, which you can see a lot, you'll see that in sixth chakra, and creativity, again, throat, I say this a lot in medium classes, I know, but throat and pelvis, they're totally connected. They're all connected. These are really connected. Mm-hmm. And I do this a lot with women because women are really blocked in birth, traditionally, because we've been suppressed in these areas. And if you were to look at a picture of the yoni and the vocal cords.
Oh, yeah, I just did in my anatomy book.
It's, they look at, almost identical, like, yeah, in a very weird way. It's tissue, the way the way that they look
and operate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So think about giving birth. If I'm on lockdown down here, ain't no baby coming out, right? If I'm like closed down, right, clenching. But if I release and open, and I open, that's why so many women, to breathe out when you're giving birth. Because it feels very natural. If you're giving birth, you get my baby. But you've heard these stories of people screaming. It's not that, I mean, they could be in pain, but it's actually it's a release. It's a primal wanting to release energy. It's an opening.
Yeah.
So if we're in sexual shame in that second chakra and abuse and all the things that have been happening, then we're not expressing ourselves because this is where shame comes back in. And dishonesty, and mistruths, and hiding, and shyness, and all those things. It's another form of hiding. These two are very interconnected.
Mm-hmm. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did some grief work that I've done with women. Involved 5 weeks of prep meeting once a week. Mm-hmm. And I was literally just working on the somatic level mm-hmm. and inviting them to liberate themselves, to moan and wail and write what their bodies knew how they wanted. And I was also speaking to like our historical traumas, women, oppression, stoned, burned, all the stuff, lobotomized, all that. And just to like, and that we're not crazy. You're not crazy. You're not crazy for being loud. You're not crazy for having emotions. You're not for. And then we culminated in a performance art piece / social or community practice that was a social learning place out in the plaza.
Yeah.
And we went in and we did it. And everyone experienced this activation of their womb space, heightened sense of intuition and power, like literally a clearing of exactly what you're talking about. And also there was a connection, we clearly, it's like, wow, this translates into sexual energy also, right? And how much we're also told, you have to be quiet,
right?
And so it's all to hear what you're saying, because it was an incredible level of healing, the level of pain, chronic pain that was released from women's their whole body, but like lifetimes of chronic pain moved by allowing this to release the grief and allowing themselves
so
good. Yeah, but that activation of the womb, for me too, it was, and I've been having my own practice, but never into that. Holy
wow.
It's
beautiful.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's like awesome what we're capable of.
You touched on something that we talked about in the last class, but about pain, right? Chronic pain. And that's why this is all relevant, right? Because it is all energy. And so pain, physical pain I'm talking about, is just the manifestation of all these layers. And that's when we will talk about the koshas, probably not in this class, but I could talk about it really briefly. I like to look at the koshas, the layers of the sheets, as like a tree ring almost. You've got the outer layer, and then it's rings, okay? And all the layers are just going in, eventually, to the causal body, or the heart, or the soul, whatever you want to call it. But so the physical layer is the bark. If you're feeling something on the physical layer, this has been going on for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Sometimes it's acute, like you fall and, you get inhaled. Right? That's not so much like it's been happening a long time, although we have some would argue that was coming to you.
Yeah, incoming pain, I think, as they describe it.
Yeah.
Mm.
So,
yeah.
Incoming pain, stored pain, which would be what you're talking
stored
about.
Stored pain, that's what I'm talking about.
Energy, right?
Yes.
And then outgoing pain.
Okay.
Is what I create for people to.
Okay. Oh, I love that. It's incoming, stored, and outgoing.
Mm-hmm.
Love that. That's beautiful. So I'm talking about stored pain right now.
Yeah.
And that. And then so what Candace is talking about and what we're all talking about is that outer layer, that tree bark, that outer ring, your bones, your muscles, all the stuff that's happening that you feel, that's been going on for a long time, energetically. From a thought to an experience to a belief system to a narrative that you have about people, whatever it is that started when you were developing these chakras. Because that's how deep it goes. This is when you first came into the planet, and this is how you were learning, how you were developing. So, it's all relevant. So when you're a yoga teacher, and a somatic body worker, a grief worker, whatever you guys are, and you're all doing good things in the world, knowing some of this information gets really poignant because of that. Oh, you've got something in your hip. And then you can deduce a little bit. It's not like you're going to go, oh, well, you definitely have some sexual trauma.
Mm-hmm.
No, because you don't know. It could be lots of different things. It doesn't have to be sexual trauma. But you can start to inquire. How
old
is Right. It could have been an accident. So you say things like that. Did you have an accident? And they're like, no, it just kind of started. Well, what happened in your life around when that started? I got a divorce. Oh, interesting. So did you have problems with your husband? Yeah, and then as you get to know them, you're not going to deduce all this in one session, but as you get to know them, you might find out that they have an old family lineage problem with the dad and this, that, right? And it can go, the Pandora's box can open and a lot of stuff can happen.
Well, like Thomas Nyer said, and he's who kind of described incoming stored pain, and he said stored pain can be from several different things. It can be stored physical pain, it can be traumatic pain, emotional pain. And that's where your fascial tissues, your fascia of your body is storing all of that. And that's why
it's better, right?
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's why massage works a lot of times for people.
Yeah! I love good massage that hurts.
It's my favorite massage.
But yeah, because it is. It's storing your connective tissue, your fascia, right? So that's why it's very important as a yoga teacher to be able to hold space in a really profound way, because sometimes people will go into a back bend or a hip opener and they'll freak out.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have a traumatic experience and what for them. I've seen that. I've seen people really freak out. And so to be able to just hold that space for them and let everybody not freak out too, but to just like be with them and say, would you like me to escort you out of the room so you can handle it?
these emotions. And I'm happy to support that. And so you might have to do something like that sometime. I've had to do that, you know. And it's a real gift and a blessing for everybody else to see that yoga can do that in the body. Albeit it might be scary for them at first, but then they're like, oh wow, this is powerful stuff. Energy. So I bring that up because also for body awareness, when we're touching people, it really attunes to, you could be touching people that have severe trauma. You don't want to be touching body parts that might, you know, obviously for women that look like those are sensitive areas.
And then they really don't acknowledge how you're men.
They don't, yeah. I'm just talking about women because we're all women.
Well, yeah, yes. I didn't mean to, I just, yeah. It just,
men
I
too.
Yeah, very I sensitive. Mean, I've had men, work with men who have been afraid that I was going to physically or spiritually rape them.
Uh-huh.
Like right. To that degree of
yeah.
Sense, which we just
yeah.
Don't tend to, you
right.
Don't tend to think,
right.
Well, you know, like see the man as like this
right.
Sensitive
right.
Being.
Right.
Like,
right.
We're
right.
All
sure.
Are.
Yeah, but we're all sensitive.
Yeah.
Like, we all have our experiences.
Sexual abuse, like
yeah.
So much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're not separate. We're
yeah.
Not separate. And to be aware. Just
yeah.
Be aware
yeah.
Of these things when you're touching. And some people come to yoga because they want to be touched.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't get touched in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way of connecting too. So we've got both ends of the spectrum. People that don't want to be touched and people who really love to be touched.
Mm-hmm.
Connect. So these are things that we need to think about as yoga teachers to be aware of this stuff for that reason. For many reasons. So then we're going to go through the throat, just to, because we have to finalize the last two before we go. Sixth chakra, ajna. Ajna is command, the command center. I like to think of this as kind of meditation, you know, dancing with consciousness, but with the eyes closed. And this is where we get into light, being the, we were talking about the elements, ether, and then light. Or thought, some people will say thought, but usually I hear it's like color, seeing, intuition, imagination, clairvoyance, visioning.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people will say we really start opening up the chakras above the heart as we're developing through our adult years. Because a lot of these things are pretty advanced, right? Like, a lot of us are just coming to some of these things, if you will. As a culture, we're still in first, second, and third chakras trying to get to the heart on a generalized basis. Right? You kind of see that in like media and advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, we're starting to grow out of the sex thing a little bit. But we're still kind of there, right? Everything's about sex, drugs, rock and roll, right? Feeding your basic
options.
These are all first, second. And third chakra things. Power. It's about power and greed, which is really getting into the third chakra. When we get into the fourth chakra, which is I think where we're transcending as a culture as a whole of humanity, is when we're actually going to really start to get over that shit and be nice to him. Right? Get in the heart. But, so are we developed in fifth, sixth, and seventh? You know, who knows, but we're trying.
Like we shouldn't have to until like 70.
What's it called?
We'd know so much more.
It's called ajna. A-J-N-A.
Mm-hmm.
You have a fun name, ajna?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's acupuncture symptom.
It's a beautiful name.
Yeah.
It does mean to command. That's one of the definitions of it. And then chakra 7. Sahasrara, a thousand-petal lotus. Consciousness, thought. So I'll say thought for that last element. Consciousness, knowing, understanding, transcendence. This here says meditation. It's almost though more, almost even like, almost moving towards absorption, towards samadhi, but connection with highest consciousness. It still is body oriented, so it can't be completely, it's not enlightenment because it's still part of our energetic field as a human being. But it's connecting to the divine. And so we could go deeper and deeper into these things, but this one's like pituitary gland, which is one of the master glands of the system, where I've heard this flip-flopped, and some people call this the pineal gland, is this consciousness, because the DMT molecule, which is the spirit molecule, which is released on birth and death.
Mm.
So you'll see that flipped in some studies. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, just do that. Okay?
Did you say the name of it again?
Yeah. Sahasrara. You have to roll your R.
Two A's.
S-A-H-A-S, silent S, R-A-R-A. Sahasrara.
Sahasrara.
S-A-H-A-S-R-A-R-A.
Okay.
Yeah. Ra, ra. It's a rolled R. That's why it's hard to say. Sahasrara.
Mm-hmm.
And what's its element?
The element is thought.
Oh.
And it goes so deep. But it's kind of good to just see that, because then the koshas, this is in your book, the koshas, remember I was talking about the dreams?
Mm-hmm.
You can look at this, and there is a description of this, of what each dream is, and I often will overlay this with this, and try to show you what chakras go in which koshas. I don't know if people do that, but it just makes sense to me.
So would you do headstands for this?
Inversions for headstands, for crown chakra, for six chakra meditations, having them be in stillness, for the throat chakra, mantras, singing, some breath work, shoulder openers, fish pose. I mean, it's endless, right? But I gave you that too for the poses, right? Because you can like do a chakra kind of pose class. Like you were just doing a child pose, you could talk about like how your third eye meets the net and make it about the sixth chakra. Or you could, you know, do shoulder openers and make this about the heart and the throat. I mean, you can get creative with this energy stuff.
What you did on Tuesday in class?
Did I do that on Tuesday?
Yeah, yeah.
See?
We were singing.
I don't even know what I was doing. I just throw, you know, anything into the kitchen sink. Whenever I feel like it. Now I'm just like, okay, let's just do this. So, you know, it can be really fun. The point is really, at the end, you have a lot to work with. So if you're ever feeling like, I don't know what to teach, just grab something. Like, grab a book. I do this sometimes. I'll be like, oh, a kosha. Okay, I'll grab a kosha. Or I'll grab a sutra. Or I'll grab a chakra. Or I'll do a chakra. And then it's a little bit more interesting, maybe, than just put your right foot in between your hands. And those are great too. And I'm making it for me. Alright? Sound good? Was that interesting?
Yeah.
Somewhat interesting?
Yeah.
Somewhat boring, you know, depending on what you like.
No, I think that in massage, you know, we learn obviously the physiological part of it, and we touch very, very little on energy.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember in that class, this is a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff.
It's a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of stuff. And it goes, you can really go down the rabbit hole. Hopefully that gives you a little sense of yourself, and then if you find that interesting about yourself, then you'll learn about it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, and here's, oh, tomorrow, I'm sorry, I have an obligation.
That's okay.
I names here.
Okay, yeah.
So,
are you welcome to be here?
I probably won't be here the whole day. I might be here in the afternoon.
I think Deb is coming
in the afternoon, too.
Or maybe she's coming in the morning.
In the morning,
in the beginning of the
like at 1.
Yeah. So if they need to come in and out, I'm okay with that. So just know.
And what time?
I think it's 1 at 4:30.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah. I think it's 1 at 4:30. I'm pretty sure it's 1 at 4:30.
Will Natalie be here this weekend at all? I think she will. I think she said she'd be here tomorrow.
I really hope that didn't turn off, because right now it looks like it.